subject says it all. Thank you. One thing that I learned about coming to the U.S., it seems like air conditioning systems in the U.S., they're all set to 40. And then there's a switch between Fahrenheit and Celsius. And that's how they work. So there have been some very good presentations so far. I'd like to give credit to Evangelos. This paper is a result of mostly his master's thesis. I'm just here to present it. I'm Kira at the lower line, so obviously he did most of the work, so he deserves the credit. And the motivation for this project was that from a virtual machine management point of view, the norm today is we basically just put a lot of virtual machines on big irons. We consolidate everything that's supposed to solve a lot of problems for us, and of course it does. We also still have the old truth that most of our systems are idle most of the time, and this allows us to overcommit physical resources to the machines that we have running, and that is a huge benefit, right? That's the that's one of the arguments for consolidation. However, when the virtual machine needs to do its job, it kind of needs those resources. So that's a challenge. But even better, if the other virtual machines could spare some of their resources, perhaps that particular virtual machine could do an even better job than with just the limits we set in the outset. So that's a crucial point here. And that's that area is where what this project tries to address. Now there are some other mechanisms and approaches which try to do some reactive reshuffling of resources. So we kind of run a little bit behind, and we see, oh, someone needs resources, let's just throw a lot of resources at them. Turns out that this is actually in practice hard to do, because a lot of those mechanisms, they aren't really fast. So we might not be able to provide those resources in the time needed, because it's usually a matter of seconds or something. So this was the motivation for our research. And the problem statement was that we wanted to have a little bit more flexible approach to resource utilization. So if we have a physical limitation of the hardware that we're put all the virtual machines on, so how can we flexibly share those resources among the virtual machines from the hypervisor perspective? And our approach was a proactive system that could hopefully predict the amount of memory or resources that the virtual machines needed, and then ahead of time do the reshuffling so that the virtual machines would not notice. So it's kind of a difficult task, but so that was our approach. And with all the mechanisms to choose from, we choose a memory ballooning as our mechanism of reshuffling. And we also chose to look at only memory in this project. So for those of you who are unfamiliar with ballooning, let me try to explain to you how this works. It's basically that when we define the virtual machine, we give it a lot of memory. At least from the definition, it gets a lot of memory. And the virtual machine loads a kernel module. I think this also exists for Windows, I'm not sure. But the virtual machine loads a kernel module that's kind of like a balloon. And we can, from the hypervisor, from the outside, we could we could just inflate that balloon inside of the virtual machine. And so that kernel module will just grab memory and sit on it. And when we know when that's the case, we can actually then use that memory to others. So we can just, while that balloon is sitting on it, we know that the virtual machine will not be able to use it. So we can then, behind the curtains, basically let some other virtual machine use that. So it's a great mechanism. And it's also a very non-intrusive mechanism. We don't fiddle around with the operating system too much. And also, if you ask the virtual machine, it will always think it has, say, 4 gigabytes of memory. And so when we inflate that balloon, how much memory do I have? I still have 4 gigabytes of memory. Do you notice the balloon? Yeah, sure, there's a huge balloon here right next to me, but I still have 4 gigabytes of memory. So I'm still me. So there are other mechanisms such as hot plugging and so on, which are a little bit more difficult to use with any kind of operating system. But this is a very, very nice mechanism. So we want to utilize this in our project. So the tool that we developed called Baelicator is it's a mix of Bayesian network and allocation. You see where I'm going at? Baelicator, the tool, will assume we are in an environment where we have promised a little bit too much to our virtual machines. So we have assigned more memory than we actually have. It's kind of a key component. Then it will make predictions of how much memory each virtual machine will need in the next 5 minutes, plus a certain padding for good measure. And we will also try to not violate any maximum and minimum value, so we will not try to strangle a virtual machine unnecessarily. And we will also try to avoid hypervisor swapping. So if the hypervisor is its own operating system, so if we would move a lot of memory away from that, then everyone loses. So we also want to ensure that. And if we have a lot of memory to give, we try to be fair. And conversely, if we have to grab a lot of memory, we try to be fair as well. So before I go into what fairness means, I just want to talk a little bit more on how we calculate the prediction. The first thing we do is we define categories for memory usage. And that's kind of just a coarse resolution of how much memory the virtual machine is using. And in our case, we have 100 megabyte categories. So one category is, say, between 400 and 500 megabytes. That could be a category. So we have those categories. And then we input into our Bayesian network. And I know this is not an artificial intelligence conference, so I'm just completely going to skip explaining to you how a Bayesian network works. But there are a lot of details in the paper. So the input to the Bayesian network, the artificial intelligence engine, is the particular virtual machine, the weekday, the particular time interval that we are in, basically in the minutes, the current memory consumption, and then we get a probability for all the memory categories as an output. And then we take a number that represents that category and multiply it by its probability. So just so this sinks in a little bit, we will have a test on this later. I'll hand out the questions afterwards. I'm just kidding. Okay, so this is just a simple example. Just imagine a virtual machine. It has not much memory, just 500 megabytes of memory. Let's just use that for the sake of the argument. So that gives us, we have four categories, between 100 and 200, 200, 300, 300, 400, 400, 500. So those are the categories. So we input into our query engine. So for test server one, the future memory usage, what is it? If it's Monday, it's 7 o'clock between 55 and 59. And the current memory consumption is between 100 and 200 megabytes. So the output with any, well, there's a 14.8 chance it will remain. It's a 30.6% chance that we get somewhere between 200 and 300. There's a 49.2% chance we get somewhere in between 300 and 400. And there's a 400 to 500 chance that we are, there's a 5.4% chance that we get somewhere between 400 and 500. And this is all based on previous experience. So the Bayesian network is something that is trained by previous observation. And this is the output we then get. And then we take the number that represents that category, and in our case, it's just the middle. So the number for between 100 and 200 is simply 150. Multiply that by the probability we got out. We got a set of numbers. We summarize them. This is the prediction. I'm sorry, I cannot scroll this, but this is the prediction. Okay, so we do this for each VM every 5 minutes. Now, we have the predictions. Now what? What if we predict that everyone needs more than we actually can hand out? I guess when I was writing this, how do I make this interesting to the American audience? Well, I'll just call it politics and the redistribution of wealth. I guess if I would call it communism, You'd probably walk out right now, but... So what if we don't have enough resources for everyone? So we have a notion of fairness. And our notion of fairness is that we have an educated guess that the rich are getting richer. So a huge machine with demands, and in huge as in a large, it has a lot of memory allocated to it. If that machine needs memory, it probably needs quite a bit of memory. And a small machine, if it needs memory, probably doesn't need an equal chunk, as in the number of megabytes, as the big one. So we try to look for percentages rather than assigning equal amount of megabytes around. And conversely, when we need to claim, well, I live in a social democracy, so the rich are also getting taxed, and they need to pay quite a bit, in fact. So that's how we grab memory back again. So there's a fairness. You get more, but you also need to pay more back. These are Obama metrics, yes. Okay, so a little bit about how we set up the experiments for this. We used both generated data, you know, when we did the early experiments just to stay in control of all the variables. But then we also did some replays of observed data from servers that we had collected data from. We used this on KVM. KVM has this ballooning mechanism. We developed a special script that we put into the VM, which was able to grab memory and mimic workloads so that we can try to accurately reproduce the kind of observations that we had in real life. And we basically built this feedback loop where data was collected into a database, and the prototype used R and Perl to make the predictions from that database. So let me try to show you a little bit about the results we saw. Now this graph right here, it's you don't have to be able to read this, but it's almost 2 weeks' time. We have a web server who has certain workloads, and they have a very periodic behavior. You can see it with those spikes. And it has a big amount of memory assigned to it, although other virtual machines are also sitting on their memory. So when it's crunch time, the task starts to take a lot of time. And so these are seconds. So every time there's a pressure, we see that the load on the virtual machine shows. So that's obvious to all of us who do SysM. And so at this point right here, we enable Baelicator, and you can see those spikes go away. And this is just because there happened to be other virtual machines that didn't need their memory. So there was actually, you know, places where we can grab memory. But it shows that the mechanism of taking memory and putting it where it matters works. Another result I want to show you, this is more from replaying real-life data. We have a web server, and we had a student SSH server that we were collecting data on for a long time. And the data is the black line, and the red are the predictions. The difference between these two plots is when we stopped learning and when we started predicting. And this is a huge problem with a lot of artificial intelligence approaches, their accuracy of predicting what will happen. In the first case, you can see that we are actually predicting, we're starting to predict after 6 days of learning. And what turns out, we get a lot of these spikes right here. And they are all at 2 gigabytes of memory. And the reason for this is, this was a phenomenon that occurred if the Bayesian network had never seen anything like this before. It basically, the probability would just, screw this. I don't know. Whatever. And in our case, because the number representing the category is in the middle, and this was a virtual machine that had 4 gigabytes, we ended up at 2. So you can actually influence where you would like it to end up if it doesn't know what to do, but in our case, just ended up in the middle all the time. So this pattern means that it wasn't very good at predicting. In the other case, we actually learned for close to 2 weeks, and now you can see there's far less of the mistakes, and we are sticking pretty close to the observed values. And this brought us to learning in accuracy and every time you evaluate a tool like this, it's this is great, but you know, how much should I trust it? And the problem is always, and I like to make this just crude statement, a fundamental difficulty with historical data is historical data. It's really hard to come by good historical data when you want to do this kind of stuff, even on your own servers, because you have the immediate periodicity of your data on the weekly basis, but then you have some underlying trends which either push stuff upwards or downwards, and these influence your learning mechanisms. And if you have a lot of weeks, you probably need to start influence some weighted mechanism and some washing. And if you have gaps in your data, that causes problems too. So this is a real challenge with these kind of tools. And being accurate after just close to 3 weeks, for instance, we were up at 97% correctness. That's a pretty short time span. Oftentimes, you spend much longer time trying to learn this. Now, over to the discussion, and I'm just going to start answering the questions that you will ask me later. There's one interesting observation in the data we had, if you look at here. We never seem to predict lower than the machine happened to need. And this is an interesting property of the approach that we had, because you need to have seen it to predict it, or else you will just fall on a default. Okay, so and that's why I put the star on it, because our default was in the middle. But if you would put your default high, you know, if you don't know, okay, it needs all its memory, you know, let's not touch this one. But if you have seen it, then you start getting a probability for it. So it's a pretty neat way of doing it. And you might also ask me, why didn't we just choose the category with the highest probability? Why did we run through the extra step of having this number representing the category, multiplying that by the probability, and summarizing it? Well, the answer to this is, even though it's the highest probability, sometimes it might still be a very low probability. So we might get the highest probability with, it's a 13%, and that's our highest probability. That's just 13%. I'm not going to bet anything on that one. So that's why we tried to compress this into a single number where the highest probabilities would have the most influence. Now, this might cause a problem if you have a very bimodal distribution of the probability. So if you have, there's a very strong probability of this, and then there's a very strong probability of that, but then you kind of end up in the middle somewhere. So this might be something for the future to address. And I already answered, what is the training time? And the hard question, the answer to that question is the question back, what does your data look like? Based on our experience, if you have systems in a very predictable human-influenced environment, typically, let's say, university, office areas, so we have very good curves on our data, it works best then. If you have businesses which are much more influenced by, say, extra sales, promotions, and so on, we have a lot more unpredictability in the data. And training might take longer. And then, why only use temporal parameters in our query? Why just ask, based on what you've seen before, if it's Monday morning and this, what's our next 5 minutes going to be like? Why not ask with other factors? And that's a very good point. In fact, we don't believe that temporal parameters like the date and time of day and so on are the real pointers. But they give a pretty good indication. We think possibly number of users logged in, number of threads for the particular service that you're running on that machine, possibly the size of a mail queue for a mail server and so on. Those would be very interesting factors to build into our model. The only problem is then we end up with very specialized Bayesian artificial engines, one for each type of server. And we haven't gone down that path yet, but that's probably in the future for us. And then you might ask, can I run it and expand the Bayesian network myself? Yes, of course. Just take a couple of classes in artificial intelligence. You're set to go. No, I'm just kidding. It's actually not that hard, and it's easy to expand. It's written in R, and the actual mechanisms, logic, is written in Perl. So I think this is very accessible to all of us, and I think Vangelis and we happily share our scripts and everything with you in case you want to try this out on your own. Also, if you just have data traces and you would like us to, can you just churn through our data? We would be happy to do that as well. And it's important to remember, though, that Baelicator is not about this reactive flash mob mitigating mechanism. You know, we're not fixing being slash dotted. We're looking for the environment where we have lots of servers that, you know, remain the same and do the same thing over and over again. We just reshuffle resources under the hood. In the future, we want to expand this in different directions. And one of them is what I like to call weightlifting for servers. Now, we humans do such a thing as, even though I know I have to move a couple of boulders in my backyard, I'm not going to train this by moving other boulders in other people's backyards. I might, you know, go to a gym and prepare for it, and then I go and move just that boulder. And so we could possibly do the same thing by influencing the Bayesian network with already trained properties, because we kind of know they are right. So we don't necessarily have to let the virtual machine go through the learning if we could just, you know, infuse it with DNA of how it's supposed to work. So that's a very interesting thing, when we could do this with our mechanism. So we just need to infuse it with some other kind of data. So we're looking forward to try that. Also, we would like to go deeper into the out of limits of ballooning. And in our case, it just happened to work. We're not sure if that is true for all cases. So we want to explore more what really happens if we start ballooning in really weird scenarios where there's a lot of crazy stuff going on the virtual machines, and what are the effects. And I think this is very crucial for whether or not people want to start using this in production environments. Also, there's this other approach of reshuffling resources, which is memory deduplication, kind of a different mechanism. You find memory pages which are similar, and you just put them on top of each other, and you just have one, right? And that's different from ballooning, and a lot of hypervisors support that as well. So perhaps we should compare ballooning with that, see how that works with our approach. And then it would be very fun to try to combine something like Baelicator, which is a long-time thing, with a much more short-lived reactive behavior, kind of a knee-jerk, even an English term for something, knee-jerk behavior to fixing other kinds of crazy stuff that we haven't seen before. So, and I was hoping Pat Cable would be here because he's a master student. I was totally going to pitch that to him.
He's in the other session.
Yes, he ran away. So, I would, if there are some students interested in a topic, these are up for grabs. Especially this lower one, I think is pretty cool. And with that said, I would like again to give credit to Evangelos who did this, and I'd be happy to try and answer your questions. So this was an interesting question. So what if the machine changes what it's doing, and how long does it take for Baelicator to learn? This is decided by two factors. The first factor is how much different is a new job from the old one. If it turns out that the current data is useless, we basically start from scratch. And the other one, what is the periodicity of that new task? And that is more of a broader answer, is that if the new task is much more random, we will actually spend longer time learning it. Yeah.
Other questions? Excuse me.
Jonathan Lee from AT&T. I guess on the same subject, do you purge old data at some point? Like over time, you might see a system go use more and more utilization, but
No, we don't, because we don't have... So how do we treat data when it's growing very old? And do we have like a ring buffer where we throw out old data? Is that a correct interpretation of your question? So the answer is we actually don't do that here. I find this a very fascinating question, though, is how can we quality assure data when it's getting older? Like, how can I answer the question whether or not the data is still relevant in order to know if I throw it out? So I can just put a date of expiry on it. But if it's valuable, I should probably keep it. So I think this is worthy of more research, in fact. I would love to have that tool being presented next, Lisa. Yeah.
As an add-on to that, an observation would be that if the Bayesian learning process can continue to reinforce what it's already seen,
yes,
then it knows the data is still valid.
Yeah, so if we would connect a feedback loop, so William here was talking about, you know, if we could reinforce good results, basically. Yeah, we could connect some notion that if we notice that we are unprecise, if the system notices that it is unprecise, it could possibly, that could trigger some actions on the data. Yes.
Sharper swings, because all of a sudden you're more busy and your memory blocks won't be compressible.
I don't know if I can repeat all of that correctly for the video feed, but so your comment is basically that memory deduplication is much more vulnerable to a high level of activity on the virtual machines. Yeah.
John Detke at Groupon, do you have any way to tweak things if there's a big event coming up, say, you know, it's break and the students are all coming back on Monday and you know this ahead of time and you're like, can you tweak that?
So the question is, can we tweak the system to be prepared for certain spikes and events that we know are coming? And the answer is no, we cannot in our prototype, we cannot do that. I think this relates to the weightlifting thing. It would be wonderful if I could, if I knew it was coming and I knew the system had never seen it before, it's kind of a crucial element of the Bayesian network, it would be wonderful to influence that to some degree. Yes. Also, if I would have another server which I knew would be similar, to just extract the knowledge from that one and just infuse it into this one, and it might be a new server, but I know it has the same role. So I'm just going to utilize the knowledge from this one on that one. I think that would be a very, very valuable thing. I don't think I'm. Can we adapt the ballooning mechanism and so on to other hypervisors such as VMware? As far as I think this works for Xen. I know that Xen has a ballooning driver. I'm not an expert on VMware, but it would not surprise me if VMware would have a ballooning driver. But I'm unsure about the API to manipulate it from the outside.
Yes.
Yeah.
Just another question. Is any code being run on the VMs themselves, or is this all on the hypervisor?
Well, of course, we run the workload. Is the code run on the virtual machines, or is everything run on the hypervisor? So the workload mimicking software was, of course, run on the virtual machines. We also did some data collection on the virtual machines, but we collected most of our data from the outside, and also the decision-making part is on the outside on the hypervisor. Yes. So we assume dumb VMs, basically. Yes.
All right, thank you very much.
All right, thank you.